ladies and gentlemen, and veterans of all ages. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, you know, as the song says, a lot of respect. And tonight, one of our guests on the show is Paul Lyons. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I got a lot of respect for the 101st Airborne. When I process out to retirement, I process out of Fort Campbell, out of the 101st, and all my years went into retirement. When I was at the University of Illinois, my professor that I had, Professor Witz, his father had been a senior leader at the 101st when they went in on D-Day. And so he told me stories about that as his father relayed it, and everything was important. I got the opportunity to take the 101st out to Fort Irwin, California, and we were at the 101st out of Fort Campbell when they got deployed over for what became Operation Iraqi Freedom. So anybody out of the 101st, I mean, God bless them. They're the best of the best. Paul, before we get to you, Denise, are you there by chance? Okay. Hey, Paul, how are you tonight?
I'm fine and very doing well at this time. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, welcome to Warrior Connection, Paul. I'm glad to have you.
Thank you. And I'm glad to be on your radio station as well.
It's some time. You and I met quite a few years ago, and it's always been a total pleasure when we sat down and talked, and you taught me a lot of stuff, and you had a lot of incredible experiences that you saw during Desert Storm. I mean, the documents that you collected and have provided to the veterans community have been staggering on their value and their importance. I mean, what happened? I mean, you know, the 101st was leading right up to the front during Desert Storm, weren't they?
Yes, sir, we were, and unfortunately, like any other war, once you get politicians involved, it really messes things up. For example, we were headed into Baghdad, as far as we were concerned, and as far as we knew, and at the last minute, someone wanted to call off the ground war, and I guess so they could brag it was a 100-hour war. Because of the 30-some-odd days of the air war that preceded us, it actually took away what we considered was our main mission and goal, was to do actually what happened in Operation Iraqi Freedom, and that was to take the whole country and stabilize it, and also to get rid of Saddam Hussein. But unfortunately, that was stopped. We were stopped short. And also another sad thing about it was we had 697,000, I believe it was almost 700,000 troops in the theater compared to about 150,000 that came in during Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we had several times, if you'll note, the difference in the logistics of troops. We had 6 months to build up. And granted, we still had a lot of problems through logistics and what have you, and through NBC protection. But it would have been so much easier had we went ahead and followed through the first time. And I told everyone around me, I said, "Hey, we'll be back here in 10 years. You watch." Now, I'm not a prophet or anything. This was just a gut feeling I had, and sure enough, about 12 years after Desert Storm, here came Operation Iraqi Freedom. To finish off what we wanted to accomplish, and of course, you know, as what's going on right now with Iraq falling apart, the commander in chief who's in charge right now, he did not obtain what's called a status of forces agreement, which would allow us to have had troops on ground in Iraq to have contained any type of breakdown in their country. We could have snuffed that out in a heartbeat, but for some reason he did not pursue it, and now we see what's going on in Iraq with ISIS.
Yeah,
this could have been prevented.
Well, you know, yes and no. You know, and that's one of the conversations we've had over the years, and it's been real interesting when you think about it, because I remember all that stuff and all the plan up and the build up. I mean, you guys got at the 101st. You guys got over there early.
Yes, sir, we did.
Early to late summer of 1990?
We got over there, and now the 82nd was the first to go. They wanted to make a showing, and so they sent a small little contingency force, and then we came in after them probably around they were there about 4 August of 90 after he invaded, and 2 August of 90. We came in around the 15th or the 17th, our first follow-up forces, initial forces, and then the rest came.
Yeah, you were on full active duty at that time at the 101st. What, 1st, 2nd, 3rd Brigade, or where were you at?
I was with H Company 159th Aviation. We were 8th Battalion. I tested black boxes and infrared night seeing devices, and Hellfire rocket launchers for the Apache helicopter. So naturally, we had to be brought in to keep the birds fully functional because of all the conditions that the desert environment brings with it.
Yeah. Denise, are you there yet by chance? Okay, well, we'll continue on. Usually, Paul, as you know, Denise comes in and does an update of what's been happening in Washington and, you know, with the VA and everything, because she's so totally involved in that.
I know she is, and I stay involved, but my forte right now has been more research and gathering and sorting of documentation that I have received through the Freedom of Information Act, several documents. And I want to tell you, the soldiers from Operation Iraqi Freedom, they're coming down with a lot of the same symptoms we have. So don't let anyone tell you they're not. I know for a fact they are.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the same thing, because one of the things that we looked at when all of us, you guys all started getting sick right away, even before we got into theater, when, you know, we started putting the medical in Bowers Raiders, well, we got in there right around Thanksgiving and, you know, beginning of December, what we were already seeing, everybody sick, and medical care before the MedCom got stood up there was just a literal nightmare.
Well, what's interesting is that, if you recall, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, now we knocked out about 50% of his chemical weapons and about around 80-85% of his biological weapons. There were two bunkers we didn't know about that we didn't bomb that were biological bunkers. We hit around 90-some-odd percent of his chemical bunkers, but he was left with enough tools that he could, or enough resources is what I'm trying to get at. He was left with enough resources that he could rebuild and regroup. So when Operation Iraqi Freedom came around, some of these soldiers got hit like we did, and you know that's not been put out. As a matter of fact, if you remember, they never found any chemical or biological weapons when Operation Iraqi Freedom came around. And I'm not trying to dwell on them. I'm just telling you that because we didn't get to complete the job the first time, these guys came in there and got hit also, and that was so needless.
Yeah, one of the things, contamination was still there. You know, one of the decisions that we made, and we've talked about this a lot, and, I mean, all this stuff, back in December of 1990, you know, at the command headquarters, we made the decision, since we knew that Iraq had the chemical and biological weapons provided to them by the U.S. Army.
It goes further than that. It goes further than the United States Army. Yes, we recaptured chemical rounds that were American-made rounds, okay? A lot of them are still in crates. I saw them. They were actually put on transport transport trucks and shipped to the Kuwait International Airport with tarps over them so that troops would not see what was going on. This was under the guise of just hauling back other equipment. They were being met by DOD personnel and put into C-130 planes and flown off. And where the final destination was, we don't know. But go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so we had all this stuff. I think one of the most interesting things, and I don't know where you and I were sitting, if it was in Atlanta, but you showed me the video of the detonation at Camisea, one of the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the most incredible video, because we knew what had happened. We knew the releases were going on. We put out the alarms. And if you remember, it was so funny when Mikey Kilpatrick and all those guys and Bernie Rotzer were sending us out the memo saying, you know, hey, you guys need to go get medical care where you're exposed. And we're going, yeah, thank you, boss. You know, and all of us knew it, and we put out the warning when the alarms went off to let you know that we had the problem. But I think one of the things, in the way, when we were looking, then I go back and remember that video that you showed me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most distinctive thing, because it was like a halo, a ring from the detonation went up of the most incredible, colors and everything
like
else imaginable.
I've not seen anything like it myself. It's interesting. I just came across a memorandum the other day that was dated 22 February 96, and it was a memorandum for the director of the Persian Gulf War Veterans Illness Investigation Team, and it had to do with a total of 212 serum, that would be blood samples, that were received, and it doesn't say from who. They tested them for antibody titers to the following agents, and they found confirmations of anthrax, Y-pestis, tularensis, excuse me, let me go to the back page. Okay, some of these viruses I'm not familiar with pronouncing correctly. C. Burnetti, I guess? Vaccinovirus, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, Rift Valley fever virus, Venezuelan equine, syphilitis virus, of course, West Nile virus, that's a gimme. Sandbus virus, which I'm not familiar with. Of course, you got sandfly fever virus. Dean virus type 2. And this was all collected by the Joint Captured Material Exploitation Center.
Yeah, well, guess who ran that? Mikey Kilpatrick.
Say again?
Yeah, their labs were over in Cairo.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Navy lab you're referring to?
Pardon?
Was that the Navy lab you were referring to?
Oh, exactly.
Navy forward lab, okay.
Yeah, so all this stuff was real interesting. I mean, when we look at the whole area, I mean, you know, the U.S. and Great Britain and, you know, Germany, everybody, and the Soviets, everybody was providing Iraq with all the chem bioweapons.
Yeah. Well, especially what upsets me is Western Europe, of all countries, Germany helps set them up with their chemical facilities, and that's from Department of State files.
Yeah, that came out because it was interesting. When we first started, got it over there, and Bauer's radar was formed, you know, they needed a chem bioanalysis. We got briefed totally by the Germans. I mean, those were the guys that came in.
Right.
Because they were already there. And so we're up there at the top end of the echelon, putting all the briefings together. And all the stuff that had been used, which allowed us to write the field manual 8-285, which is medical management of chemical biological casualties.
Right.
I mean, it's so phenomenal when you go back and look at that for people that looked at it. You and I have looked at it together.
Yes, and I might want to mention that on 285, where it specifically covers the pyridostamine bromide pills, they're actually a mild form of nerve agent, which is to build up your toxicity level so that once you're exposed, you can fight longer.
Well, yeah, but exactly. The pyridostamine bromide is a nerve agent. It's a reversible bond of the synaptic junctions. And so what the decision was made, and this goes back to, you know, all the colonels and everybody and all this stuff, the original documents, well, we know that he has sarin and cyclosarin. We know he has Tabun. We know he has Soman. We know he has Novichok. We know he has, and you were the one that got the information out on the dusty agents.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you're the guy that did all that work, broke that whole story wide open. So all this stuff is there, and... So we knew we had to administer the PB pills, and what it did is it locked it up so that if you got zapped by any of these, hopefully you could get the antidotes within a fast enough time, so the atropine, diazepam, pyridoxamine chloride to reverse the whole thing. But with all the pesticide exposures, all the low-level exposure were happening, nobody went into an acute crisis. So there were no antidotes administered, and now the stuff is just building up in the body. And then you got all of the permethrin, which our clothes were saturated in.
Mm-hmm.
So all the stuff is being just absorbed into the body. And, I mean, the neuromuscular problems, you know, Denise has talked about that as ad nauseum. You relayed those to me day one when I first met you.
Yes, and I haven't gotten any better either, Doug.
Well, none of us have. I mean, it just continues to deteriorate.
Yeah.
The doctor said there's probably no hope, and the only thing they knew between the combination of spinal cord injuries, all of the neuromuscular damage and everything else, I mean, you got the pain meds that you have to live with. You have to keep active, trying to get, you know, physical therapy and all this stuff.
Well, I'm on a lot of narcotics for pain, and that's sad. I don't like taking them, but I've got to. And I also have a daughter who's sick, very sick from this, and she's got some of the... I put it out on Facebook, but I'll have to. I'm going to try to create another website and get all this stuff going together.
Yeah, Denise, are you there yet by chance?
Yes, I got added on late.
Hey, dear sweet Denise.
Hello there, Paul. I want to get that document you were just speaking of, so
I can put
it together with symptoms of
the. They knew of this, and here we were testifying to them all those years, spending our precious time and resources to give them information. They knew back in '96 all the stuff that people had already been hit with.
Yep, and they don't have them added into presumptives, but yet we had
I'm telling you, it's because Lindsay put out Arison. The cost would be so prohibitive. And now I've got my daughter is sick, and I mean she is broke out with, I don't want to really go there, but it's very graphic as far as just big wild sores all over her legs and arms. And I've had to take her to a specialized dermatologist clinic to get any type of relief for her. She's in ill health, and she did not ask for this.
No, nope, she didn't. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it would help to get that document from you, and I'll pull up all the signs and symptoms to get it out to people.
Okay.
We do need
did you hear me read off how many there were?
I heard you read it off, so if you can just email it to me.
It was signed off by, and I'm not familiar with this person, and this came out in 96. It was signed off by a colonel, or I guess VC, what would that be, Veterinary Command?
Yeah.
Yep.
George E. Lewis, Jr., full colonel, commanding. But the address on the memorandum went to the U.S. Army Medical Materials Development out of Fort Detrick.
Well, yeah, everything comes out of Detrick.
They knew this back in 96, but they went ahead and carried on these hearings. We spun our wheels. The only people that we probably got help from was the press that was there, because DOD must have been twiddling their thumbs saying, hey, you know, we already know this, but we're going to have to do this dog and pony show, so we can let you all feel like you're doing something productive.
Well, you know, I got to think, I mean, Paul, I got to you and met you because of Denise, and Denise, you know, getting us all together, and Paul, all the work you've done over the years. I mean, I definitely got to thank you for everything you've ever always done.
Hey, it's been a life calling that I did not ask for, but
none of us did.
But you know what? Once I know that, but I'm telling you, once I found out how critical this was, I put all effort into it, and that's why I've done so much research on it.
Yeah, go tell some more. I mean, Paul, we have not had you on the program before, so it was so important to have you on tonight. Mm-hmm. Just a general discussion about everything else. I mean, you've been involved trying to get medical care not only for yourself and for your family, but everybody else and all this stuff. You crashed, you burned like the rest of us. I mean, all the stuff that we had touted and said has all come to total realization now in the VA scandals. And Denise and I have talked about it, but again, one thing you've put a little bit in. What is your insight, and what would you recommend as far from your years of experience and working on it and having all different levels of stuff? Where do you see the VA at now, and what do you think needs to happen within the VA to make anything better, if they even could?
I think that the authority that President Obama gave to the new director of the VA, I don't think he gave them enough authority. I think to be able to fire those who run the clinics, or the regional centers, I should say, I don't think that goes far enough. I think that he needs to have the authority to fire people even lower down who just are nonchalant and who are not trying to carry out the letter of the law.
Well, I distinctly remember you had a significant amount of problems trying to get your own medical care where we had to try and help you.
See, I was at one time housebound, and because of my advocacy, now I'm 100% permanent total. They took my VA actually reduced and took my housebound away from me, if you can believe that. Here I am, I can't hardly get out of my own home.
They did what?
Yes.
Go
they took my
this.
Housebound away from me back in Indianapolis when I was living up there. They sure did. And but they did go ahead on one of my readings certify that I was a biological. One of my injuries from the neuropathy was from a biological agent. A matter of fact, I don't know if I can pull it out at this time. I've got so many other documents, but one of my ratings states that I was hit with a biological agent. Believe it or not.
Well, we knew that happened because
where
the 101st traveled.
Pretty gutsy.
We're the 101st traveled on the MSRs. I mean, we had total confirmation, so there's no question at all because, you know, not only did the Iraqis use it on those things, we did too, and we blew everything up, and then the contamination we left from all of the hazmat and the burn pits, you know, all the way along, it's just a staggering problem.
And it will continue to be. I hope, by the way, I've came across information now concerning mortuary affairs, And that would be regarding the decontamination of human remains for shipment back to the United States.
Yeah, go through that one. That's a good one.
Mm. Well, let's see. I can go through one of them here real quick. Let me. It's a PowerPoint. Let's see what I got here. Now, they started running across this. It goes back as far as Desert Storm, okay? And during Operation Iraqi Freedom, they purchased two interim commercial systems. They lost one for some reason in Iraq, but they began limited objective experiments known as LOEs to refine the requirements, and then they did what's called rock drills, trying to figure out what they were going to do. It's pretty detailed, but let's see if I can get to the shortcomings of what we've got here. Okay, and they call this the decon of contaminated remains DOD's highest priority for mortuary affairs action. Okay? And 1 second here. Don't let me take up time on this. If you want to talk about something else till I can get to the specific part of it, please carry on, because I don't want to waste any time on this station.
Oh, you got all the time in the world. We're an open. We're open time. We have nothing to worry about.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. They had a hard time getting funding for this. I don't know why it was slow. It talks
highest
about
priority, and yet they had trouble getting funding.
Pardon me?
Highest priority, but yet they had.
No, that
trouble.
Was for mortuary affairs community, not for all of DOD. Okay, but still, it was their highest priority. And it mentions the shortfalls that DOD, I think I put that out on Facebook, but I did not put out the full information because some of this is still, I don't want to go there. but it's touchy, I guess you could say. And it mentions, if I can get to it, it mentions, of course, what the shortcomings are that we have, and that's that DOD actually has no way to they're finally coming around to it, and it's not in this particular one, but DOD does have shortcomings on how to completely decontaminate the remains. What they've gone to now is they're irradiating the bodies, okay?
Uh-huh.
Which will destroy the, and then what they'll do is a DNA harvest of the casualty before they hit the body with irradiation, because it destroys everything in the body, including DNA, and that's how they're killing the toxins that are, or should I say, the biological agents that are still in the body, even though the body's dead. That would be from anthrax and other known agents. So they just lack great capabilities, and they're still behind the eight ball on that. And they also put down in there, if they could not decontaminate the body, they just buried them.
Well, see, one of the problems we ran into, and this is what did happen during Desert Storm, because we were involved in this, the contaminated remains and everything, because there was no way to get them out of the destroyed and contaminated vehicles. There was no way to decontaminate them. So a lot of those remains just got buried in place, because one of the threats and the problems we had, we knew we had no effective decontamination capability for NBC bringing the body back or the remains back. There is none. There is none to this day.
Well, but what they were running across, especially during Desert Storm, what they were doing is letting the bodies weather, because they had no way. Now they've got like a pouch they can put them in that has like three different layers to try to protect the mortuary affairs workers from getting contaminated. So, I mean, they've developed some ways. It's taken a while to do it, but they do lack the capability of certain things. Now, I don't know if waivers are being granted or what by the Department of Transportation or whoever is in charge of allowing the remains to be brought into the United States. I think they're allowing them to come into the United States now. Now, whether it's closed casket or not, I don't know exactly. I wish I'd had more time to prepare for this interview. I'd been able to read verbatim what some of this stuff says, but it did cite several shortcomings that DOD lacked in trying to decontaminate the remains, even to this day.
Yeah, that's one of the things, and that goes back again to understand the chemistry and the physics involved and everything. It's just not possible.
Right.
I think one of the things that bothers me the most, and Paul, you again, you had already mentioned the documents and the stuff that you guys captured and brought back, but we know prior to Desert Storm, obviously, that the U.S. military and everybody was involved providing the weapons and the chem bio stuff to Iraq to use against the Kurds.
Right.
They absolutely use it against the Kurds. After the completion of the ground war, when the Kurds decided up an uprising against Saddam Hussein, when we didn't help them, again, the Iraqi had the equipment and the helicopters still flying to go after the Kurds.
Right.
And then the latest stuff that's come out here in the last, well, I guess maybe less than 12 hours, is they're having serious discussion where the current military is going to provide weapons to the Kurds up in the northern part of Iraq.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, now, wait a minute. We gave Iraq the weapons originally to go on the Kurds. Then when they right. had an uprising after Desert Storm, Iraq had the weapons left over that they used on the Kurds, the helicopters and everything else. Now all of a sudden the Kurds are in the uprising all over the place and they're fighting again. The whole shebang is a powder keg ready to blow up. But then what I was talking to somebody else, now wait a minute, we're going to provide weapons to the Kurds again? Now, the Kurds, first off, don't want to be part of Turkey. They don't want to be part of Iraq. They want to have their own separate nation.
Right, right, and they should.
And, you know, what happens when all of a sudden you've got this powder keg ready to go up, and all of a sudden the Kurds get a whole bunch of sophisticated weapons. Now, which way is it going to go? They're going to attack into Turkey, which they have been doing since antiquity. They're going to attack into Iraq. They've been fighting there, and as we know, mm-hmm. that was part of the stuff involved. Saddam had to keep the Kurds in check to hold
right.
everything together. And,
okay.
again, looking at the Kurds is where most of the oil wells
right.
are.
Okay, I did come across on a PowerPoint slide I printed out, on the highest priority action on contaminated remains the problem. It said DOD lacks, this was in 2007, DOD lacks capability to decontain human remains to identified standard, transport contaminated remains back to the U.S., and the current policy at that time, this was 2007, was to perform mortuary affairs mission, which supported a positive ID, and it states once again, if cannot decontaminate, enter in theaters, last resort. And bottom line states, if a contamination fatality occurs overseas today, we cannot return remains to U.S. for disposition to families. Remains will be temporarily stored or interred until capability is developed. I wanted to get that out there. But I believe, if I'm correct, I was looking at another file I've got here, that because of the irradiation process, they have came out with a special permit to transport contaminated remains.
Well, you know, we have to come on down there. Irradiation will handle biological stuff, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you got some biological agents, you can irradiate them, and that will kill them. I mean, that's part of
yeah.
the idea of irradiation
right.
for meats and foods.
Right.
But that doesn't do anything for hazardous materials or chemicals or the organic
well, yeah,
compound.
What's going on with that? I guess they think they'll put them in a burn pit and that will take care of everything.
Yeah, I had the conversation with the Danville VA senior leadership the other day when I was in for care, where they looked at the documents again, same documents that you provided me, and we've looked at before, where, you know, we started the burn pits and hazmat way back in Desert Storm,
uh-huh.
and people got sick and all that stuff was happening because you guys were out there in the 101st, the 82nd, which
yeah.
was burning everything in a big pile and then walking away and, you know, kind of putting sand over it, or at least attempting to put sand over it if they even did that.
Well, that's the one thing I'm curious about. I'm sure they used a GPS system to mark where the remains were. And I'm also curious as to how they tell the family members. I guess they must have altered dates on when they died and when they could possibly come back and who they were. I mean, I don't quite follow that. Do you?
Well, you know, you had part of the body came back and then the other parts didn't come back. I mean, I remember there was a whole bunch of contaminated equipment.
Pardon me?
Buried in the desert in a massive hole that Dave Kiefer and the guys, you know, from the EOD units there at the command at KKMC, you know, had buried and pushed into a hole.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that, you know, the 144th had done when we were doing all the stuff. I mean, we still got the photographs.
Were they putting all the remains together in one huge pile?
Yep.
Well, that sounds just like something we would be doing like during World War II, and my God. In Korea, it was done, but wow. How's that for respect for the deceased, huh?
So where do you, I mean, you know, where do you think we go? We've got all this stuff that's been happening, all these revelations that have been discussed by all of us. And, Paul, you've been at the forefront trying to get this information out. I mean, you were doing when I met you through Denise.
Yeah.
Where do you think the VA needs to truly go? I mean, is it possible for the VA to clean up their act? And what would they need to do to clean it up from your perspective?
Well, they need to streamline the claims process for one thing. And not let people become destitute waiting on their claims to be processed. I don't feel that's right. And they also need to get their act together on instituting these claims and letting people know at least what they've got coming to them and on a certain date. People need some type of certainty to. When they're going to be able to get their disability. For those who are truly sick, and I'm not talking about anybody who's not sick. I met one major one time who wanted to try to get a free ball ride on this. He wasn't sick at the time. He may be now. But he and I had a wall-to-wall counseling at that time, if you know what I mean, because I was really upset that someone would want to get a free ride when we've got so many sick people with limited resources to take care of them. And I would like to think, and I want to give this new director, and I don't recall his name over the VA, I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt. I mean, we haven't seen him in action yet. He did fire, from what I read in the news here. He did relieve a couple of executives at certain regional offices. So apparently he's doing things that, you know, look like they're going to be right. I hope that he continues on and be honest with us. I'd like to see him give us clear reports on what he's doing to change the VA, the culture of the VA.
And what do you?
Well,
I mean, the culture of the VA is a nightmare. Kind of describe what your experience of the culture is and what you think it should be.
Well, I've been up in Indianapolis. I was harassed by the VA up there. Over the phone, even at my own home, called and yelled at. And unfortunately, I record the gentleman's name and what all happened. And they were really after me, trying to knock down anything they could on me because they thought they could get away with it. And unfortunately, I even contacted Congressman Burton's office, and I don't know what happened to him. He used to be a big advocate for other things. He wouldn't even do a thing for me. So when I've moved back here to Arkansas, I have filed a congressional getting my claim for housebound speeded up, and I'm going to see what happens. And if it doesn't, I'll file another one with the U.S. Senator. And I will also enclose information showing certain things that need to be known to the public if it doesn't happen beforehand.
Yeah, the 101st had learned an awful lot and seen way too much, and too many people got sick. And I mean, today the 101st has paid the cost, and all of the guys. I mean, you've kept in touch with the guys at 101st with you to some degree. And what's happened to everybody? I mean, you guys. I mean, you and the 82nd led the charge. I mean, what happened to everybody? Do you have any idea?
Well, a lot of them are dead now. They've died at an early age through either brain cancers or heart attacks or things like that. Which really is amazing when you're talking about a lot of those guys being in their 50s and late 40s. So, I don't know. One of these reports I'm looking at is they have came up with a special permit to allow for safe transport of contaminated remains within the U.S. from abroad. And what they're doing is... let's see, it says contaminated remains shall not be marked and packaged like regular hazardous materials. I've still got a lot to go through, so are you holding this weekly, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, well, next week I think I'll be on top of my game to to tell you all what I've got information on.
Yeah,
and I would like to start another... And Kurt Love really did a wonderful job helping me set up the Desert Storm Justice Foundation, but unfortunately, the people who I was working with lost interest and DSJF, and I could not get further backing from them, so I let the website go. Unfortunately, I should not have, but when you don't have backing from the founders, you cannot do certain things like you wish you could. And I guess they were just burned out, so.
Well, burnout has been happening with everybody, all the frustration and
everything. Well, it's happened to me. I mean, I have to walk away sometimes, but there's a part of me that will not let this go, because that memorandum that came out when we first came back, I carried it in one of my front pockets on my battle dress uniform, stating clearly that there was no information, classified or unclassified, on contaminated remains, if you recall, signed off by the Joint Chief of Staff and also the Secretary of Defense at that time. And if anyone ever wanted to reproach me on anything I said, because I was on the TV news media out of Nashville a lot at that time, I would pull that out and let them read it. And I'm sure that the division had a copy of it, because I was never actually challenged on it but one time, and that's it.
Yeah, I remember when we were setting this all up, and Zulus is putting everything together, D.G. Zulus, he was a MedCom commander, and he's getting the Colonel Erwig Bauer and Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath. I mean, Denise knows Andres. Paul, you met Andres too, didn't you? I think you met him when
I may have,
Atlanta.
Jim. I've got such short-term memory loss now. I have a real problem with gathering my thoughts. They come and go, unfortunately.
Yeah, but again, one of the things we had to put together, and again, now it's formally in the Medical Mass Chemical Biological Handbook that's put out by, you know, Aberdeen and Dietrich and everything. But the decontamination procedures and protocols, I mean, when we look today, the decontamination protocols take an area, you know, multiple sizes of a football field, because you've got to come in and you've got to do all your triage and contaminate area. You got to do all that stuff. You got to stabilize, and you got to thoroughly decontaminate, and then you got to get them across the hot, out of the hot zone into the cold zone.
Oh, it's
and
a
whole thing again.
Very complicated, you know, procedure.
And then what's interesting today, when we see it, all these little fire departments and everybody around here, when they put stuff up, somehow they're going to do it in an area the size of a car garage or something.
That's not good. That's not possible.
You know,
they're going to be in for a big surprise if some major event did it. Unfortunately happen around here.
You know, and then the other thing too is, I know they've come out, and I think we've seen it, we've talked about it, they've been pushing out, the Department of Defense has been pushing out, because they couldn't use it anymore, those decontamination trucks.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you're going to climb in the front of the truck, and you're going to decon, and get climbed out the back of the truck, and nobody's figuring out, well, the contamination's going to go along the outside skin of the truck, and yeah, it's going to be inside the truck, and it's going to go all over, and you just got to stop and wonder and go, what happened to all this common sense and all the stuff that was put together by an incredible group of troops and military personnel with common sense that went the way of the dodo bird for political and economic reasons?
Well, that's sad. And, you know, I would like to see Desert Storm Vets and Operation Iraqi Freedom Vets, for those who are ill, I'd like to see us unite. And I'm thinking very seriously about starting a nonprofit group, at least here in the state, that would include them, because a lot of these guys have came back with very similar symptoms, if not identical symptoms, from the same type of exposures we have got. So we need to include them, and we need to embrace each other. We really do. We should not leave them out, and they should include us.
Well, the IOM, Denise IOM came, that's well over a year and a half ago, or over a year ago, when they came out with a report confirming that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was way over a year and a half now.
Well, was that, Denise?
The real tragedy here is not informing. Paul, I don't even know if they've informed the VA from the DOD of what all the situation is.
Well, and
you
I
know,
have no information.
And therefore, you still have Gulf War vets going in and having doctors totally ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way. They're ignorant. They don't know what we were exposed to. They still, you know, kind of cast off the Gulf War vets until you keep trying and you find somebody that's going to pay attention. But,
right.
I mean, how has your experience been lately with the VA, Paul?
I haven't gotten the cold shoulder. I had to go down there, but because I cannot drive long distances without getting ill, I've had to have someone drive me.
Uh-huh.
And that's hard. That's became hard on me. So I've actually had to cancel some appointments because I had to have someone drive me. And my wife's trying to take care of both me with my illness and my daughter who's sick, and I'm not going to ask her to do something like that. So I usually find a veteran friend. I've got a Vietnam vet. He's like a brother to me. When, of course, he's sick. He's 82 years old. I mean, he's the guy who's driven me from where I live, which is around 160, 180 miles one way, to Little Rock, to get me down there for appointments. So it's been hard for me to find someone who I live in a small town now, and there's not a lot of OIF or Desert Storm vets around here. It's not like outside of Campbell where I could find, you know, thousands of them literally, or maybe hundreds who would like to participate.
But when you get down there, they...
No, they haven't been rude to me or anything like that, no.
No, no, I don't mean rude. No. I mean knowledgeable.
Well... one doctor, I need new glasses, and I have to, believe it or not, this is what was crazy. I went down there for an eye exam. Well, my eye exam. This doctor examined my eyes, and this could have been done in one day. For some reason, it wasn't. And he was holding a particular eyeglass up to me, and he was held at a certain position to my like top right of my right temple. And he says, "Does this look better now?" I said, "Yeah." And he mumbled out loud. He says, "Well," he said, "all the Gulf War vets have this unusual reason to see perception in this area." And I said, "Can you put that in writing?" I don't know if he did or not, because I haven't did a request on my records lately. But for some reason, he wouldn't write me out a script. I had to go back for to get my glasses. And, you know, I thought it was a real bummer, you know, to have to go all the way back down there. They could have done it. That was a part that wasn't streamlined, I can tell you.
And they didn't go back
for another appointment, even though he checked my eyes. I could have had my script that day.
Yeah, they didn't explain to you what they're talking about on the perception problem.
No, he didn't know that. But as far as being rude, they were not rude, so I cannot say that.
Okay? Yeah, but it's just as bad to have something said to you about perception problem, and all the Gulf War vets have it.
And then stop there in mid-sentence, right, yeah.
But no explanation of what are you actually seeing. You know, tell me, write it down.
Right.
You know,
and that's a problem that I think you'll find with a lot of the caregivers. They will notice something, and they may mention it verbally, but they might not go over to their notes and put it in there. And for that, I truly don't understand. I don't know if it's from lackadaisical reasons or that's the way they think they've always done it. But, you know, sometimes if they see something, I think they ought to immediately go have their notes right there and put it in there.
Right. Well, it's not only that, Paul. I'm talking about if they're noticing something on Gulf War vets, you know, be it vision or whatever, that should become common knowledge, at least to the doctors and to the vets coming in.
Well, this one doctor, like I said, who examined me, this optometrist, he had noticed this similarity with me and other Gulf War vets. Now, whether he himself wrote down a correlation for all of us, how many of us were having that particular vision issue, I don't know if he did or not. I think that they should do things like that. Of course, that makes common sense.
Because you know I've brought up vision problems, dental problems, and we've had no attention paid to those, research papers or any documentation in a medical journal of what they're seeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that should be publicized, that if they're seeing this on a vet, you write up a number of case studies that you've seen it in this many vets that you've cared for. And, you know, put it into the, you know, medical journals appropriate, you know, like for your eye journals.
Right.
And, you know, get it out there so that other people can be aware. Otherwise, we're working in a vacuum of lack of information.
Well, one thing on the eye problems, and I'll thank God for me, I mean, with the VA up here, we force a recognition. But, again, we had the internal reports. But Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, the incredible group of eye doctors down there under Dr. Philip Custer have been seeing this stuff and treating, you know, eye casualties from the VA and everything coming back from Desert Storm Iraqi Freedom. And so that problem is real. Paul, I'd like to go.
They need to shortly. Listen, let me interject. They need whoever that doctor is. He needs to have a memorandum or study put out on that, and put it out to the VA through their website, so that under Go for Illness, where they have that heading, and let us read about it.
Yeah, and I mean, what did they find, Doug, on yours?
Had happened, and what they, again, my surgery, next batch of surgery is scheduled now for the 18th. I didn't get to tell you, the doctor just scheduled it and got it approved. VA pays for it, but we're going to do it at a civilian hospital connected with the University Med School. But what has happened, and what they explained, what we had is a chemical toxin, some pesticides, and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They layer on the outside of the eye, and then migrate around the eye. So what you're seeing is the neuromuscular damage of the eye. Then the other thing you're seeing is, again, in my case, a radiation cataracts. The other thing, what too they are finding, is there's damage to the back and the retina, scar tissue formed in the eye and in the lens. So, I mean, it's something that is showing up, and what they're seeing, and the doctor and nurse and staff pointed this out to me, they're seeing this the same thing in the chemical industry and the pesticide industry. You know, and the farmers and the people that work in this the facilities, and they're seeing the same thing now in not only Desert Storm, but...
Yeah.
The current kids, so we know we definitely have some unique capabilities.
Oh, do I have enough time to say something about my eyes?
Sure.
A little incident I had, or do we need to carry on?
No, you have time. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. When I was still with the 101st, they documented that my eyes were burnt with chemicals, and they sent me, the division optometrist sent me up on a little special orders to Walter Reed. I was examined by four or five Fulbert colonels, and they put a certain a color. They looked through a certain spectrum when they dilated my eyes. And this guy was so amazed. The initial guy who examined me, he called his three or four buddies up by their first name, of course. Hey Joe. Hey Bob. Hey whoever. Come here. Look at this guy's eyes. And then the doctor who sent me there, he drew a diagram of what my eyes look like, and I've got pits in them from where the chemical agent, now which one I don't know, actually destroyed certain spots on my outside of my cornea. I just wanted to mention that. And right after they saw that, they were going to walk into this meeting room just out adjacent to the lab where they tested me. They all start to go in there to have a meeting with this. Well, I'm walking behind them, okay? I'm thinking I'm invited also. These are my eyes, you got to remember.
Yeah.
So they're getting ready to shut the door, and I'm walking right behind them. They say, well, you go with Staff Sergeant Lyons. I said, I'm going in here with you. We're going to have a conversation about this, aren't we? They said, no. I said, we've got orders cut for you. You get back down. I was on the third floor. You get back down on the first floor and get your orders and get your yahoo. I don't want to say it online. Back to Fort Campbell, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, I found that rather weird, you know. They won't talk about my eyes. They exclude me from it. They go into a closed session, and I didn't like that at all. But that's what happened.
You've been,
we've still got things to do, battles to fight, unfortunately, with both agencies, and they do have agreements with each other.
You know,
multiple
one thing we need
agreements.
To, obviously, Paul, and if you want to, and Denise, I mean, we need to continue this conversation for sure next week again.
Yes.
I mean, I haven't got anything planned. Denise, you have anything planned for next week other than open conversation like this again?
Yeah, the open conversation, I think we need to continue it. I have a page set up for rashes, and I'm getting pictures that
Are you talking about Facebook you set up?
Yeah, on
did
Facebook.
You see did you see if some photos I submitted? They were my daughter's legs where they had big open cracks on them, and they say it's psoriasis, but they're just all over her, and she's taking certain medications. Her whole body was covered up, and, you know, that's one thing I would like to see put back into law. They started that program, and they ended it, and that is where the spouses
and
the children were allowed to be treated at the VA.
Right.
That needs to be put back into law right now. That is one thing that needs to be done.
Well, I think we definitely need you back next week, Paul. And, Doug, I'm not sure if I'll be able to be online because I'm going out to the War-Related Illness Center. Wow. Out in Palo Alto.
Now, how did you get that one?
Well, you know, I got mad and I went back into the VA. My only purpose in going back to the VA was to get a referral. And I
told them, need a referral like that, but I don't know.
I told them quite bluntly, the only reason I've come back to you guys is the only way you can go out there is have a referral from a VA primary care doctor.
Right.
And I said, that's what I want.
Well,
now, if you're not going to give it to me, tell me, because we'll quit playing this game, you know?
Well, that's what I've got to do. I've got to make that happen for me. I need to know what's going on in my body. I'm too sick right now. I counted the medications I'm on. I'm on 14 different medications a day.
Yeah.
And that's something's wrong, you know?
You know, I remember, Paul, when you and I first met, I mean, we're living together, you know, rooming together, and we're
you're talking about the time we had to share that little bed or cot because we didn't have any room.
Yeah, and we both got the same rash, and it's kind of like, well, here's my rash, here's your rash.
Well, and at that time, hey, what's the problem? It's probably the same rashes. Who cares?
So anyway, we've sent other people out to the War-Related Illness Center.
Yeah.
So in a couple of weeks, I'd like, next week I'm counting on you guys covering things. I will get on if I can, but I'm not sure what they have me scheduled for once I get out there on Sunday. But I think we need to get some people on and talk to them about the war.
Is it a two-week program, Denise?
Huh?
You're going to be gone for 2 weeks?
No, it's just the 4 days. It's the war-related
illness. Well, get the information for me because I need to make contact and I need to get out there ASAP.
I'll send that. I'll get that information to you. Now, the other thing, too, I want to cover here in the last couple of minutes is, again, from the War Injury Center, again, and Matt Reinhardt put this all out in the Advantage on the Airborne Hazards and Open Pit Burn Registry. I've been attempting to do that. When I talked to Matthew Reinhardt, he said, Doug, you, Denise, Rollo, all you guys definitely need to get in this stuff. So we've been trying to do it. But lo and behold, the link into this stuff, you have to do a survey online. And guess what? That's Mikey Kilpatrick's group. Well, now Bill Smith is running it.
Is Mikey Kilpatrick still working this issue?
Well, he's retired now. There's a new guy, but it goes up through them, and you can't get in there because you have to have an advanced DODDS log on to get into it, and what we found out here at the Danville VA is totally impossible. And
wow.
So we got that roadblock put on and trying to get, you know, into the Airborne Hazards and Open Pit Burn Registry, because as we've talked about now, and again, Paul, this is where we need to have you back and everything, and is there any way, Paul, that you have... Did you get some of those photos or videos that you have showing all this stuff that we can get that stuff copied or put into our archives for the show?
Yeah, I got. I think I could probably do that. What are you talking about for the show? Do you have who? What could you explain more?
Well, just for the archives here for Gary Knoll and everything associated with Warrior Connection, so people.
I've been up to Gary Knoll's residence. Is this his station?
Yes, it is.
Well, no one told me. I had an email. Well, you tell Gary I said hi. He's one of my heroes.
Gary, you just got another comment.
He has really kept his eye on the ball for us.
Well, that's where Gary set this up, so that's what we've been doing this, because, as you know, we were all involved in a documentary that's essential for everybody to see. You know, so again, one thing, we're running out of time, but Paul, one thing I'd like to ask you to do, and Denise, if you can help or we can line other people, what I'd like to talk about also is how do we respond to a PTSD crisis? You know, and what needs to be done? What happens when a person is stepping over the edge? What kind of response needs to happen? And I think that's one of the things that we need to figure out when we get people involved. I know the three of us could talk about it ad nauseum because we've been involved in, you know, putting together responses and everything else. But there's other individuals that are out there like to join us because there's so much that we need to do. And what I'd like to do over the next month or so is focus on different areas and different groups. Okay, so we got solid recommendations to the VA, to this new guy, how to fix things. Where are things broken, and how do we get it fixed?
Right.
But we're going to need a lot of help from all of the people that have been involved in this to get that word out.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the public, you know, VSOs or wherever you come up, the national leadership. I'm talking the grunts down in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where you guys all started. When I got involved, Paul, you guys were totally fighting this battle when I got involved.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Next week we need more of the document review that Paul has a lot of. I don't know if we're still in touch with Jim Brown, but he has a lot of documents. I think we need to concentrate on sharing some of the information from the documents on the radio. Then I think we need to have a program of ones that have gone to war-related illness and what they've been put through and if it's been helpful and what needs to change there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's really critical. Paul, can you join us again next week?
I believe I can. I'll put it on my calendar, but my memory's bad.
I'll email you.
A call, if you could, a courtesy call, maybe an hour beforehand or something?
Yeah, we'll do that. And while we're doing it, just as we finish up, the War-Related Injury Study Centers, I'm going to give out those numbers again for the three places.
First of all, Doug, before you start giving out the numbers, the one thing you need, people, is you've got to have a primary care doctor at the VA
I want to stress something on doctor's care. There was a memorandum I still got that came out that stated that VA was ordered to recognize, this was put in the Federal Register as well, diagnoses from private practitioners.
Right.
Now, I've got that. If someone's gone to a private practitioner and they think the VA will not accept it, unless it's been rescinded, which I've never seen, it should still be good.
And the process is you have to go through your primary care doctor and get her to put those in the record for you.
Yeah.
That is the process.
Well, the drawback, the sad thing about C&P, compensation and pension with the VA, is that if you don't word it almost verbatim the way their claim reads, the way that diagnosis reads, they don't want to recognize it. I don't know why. And I'll have to get an updated C&P book, but I'm just telling you, I've seen that happen before.
Right. But to get to the, let me finish with the war-related illness. You must. This is the one thing you've got to get. You cannot call them yourself, Doug. They have to have a referral from a VA doctor, and that's done by computer. And it goes into the war-related illness center for that location. And after that, the War-Related Illness Center should contact you within, I'd say, 2 weeks to line up and talk to you and get you set up. But you have to have the VA doctor that is your primary care refer you through the computerized system, or else you go nowhere. You cannot just call the War-Related Illness Center and get referred that way. You have to have the doctor from your VA primary care to refer you.
Okay, well, yeah, good, exactly right. Let's continue this, Paul. We'll continue on.
Okay.
If you can get stuff and you and I be in contact, Denise, let us know what happens, and we'll try to line everything up. Thank you very much. We're out of time here. God bless you, Paul. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.